summer party, Christmas party, all night long. Have a jolly Christmas, have a merry Christmas. I bake a cake for Christmas party, sweet cake party.
Listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. This is Reciprocity Radio, and I'm your host, Amanda. This is a show all about food, cooking, eating, drinking, sharing recipes, all that kind of fun stuff. And what you heard at the top of the hour was Shonen Knife with Sweet Christmas. I might give you a hint as to what today's theme is. As we know, it's we're getting close to Christmas here. In the first week of December, and I just thought I'd do an episode with some of my favorite holiday songs and talk a little bit about one thing that always comes up at Christmas, which is cookies. That's today's gonna be about cookies, the history of cookies, what's the difference between a biscuit and a cookie, because if you're a fan of the Great British Bake Off like me, it's very confusing when every cookie is actually a biscuit. We're going to talk about gingerbread, and yeah, why does Santa even want cookies? Why not something other than cookies? I don't know. Speaking of the holidays, I'm pretty excited. Next Thursday is Radio Free Brooklyn's holiday party. It's Thursday, December 13th. We are having a party from 7 to 10 at Braven Brewing Company in Bushwick. RSVP at radiofreebrooklyn.org/holiday2018 to get 2 free beer tickets at the party, plus access to the exclusive VIP area. We'd like to thank Braven Brewing Company for supporting RFB during this holiday season. Please visit the Braven Brewery Bar and Kitchen at 52 Harrison Place. Bar online at Raven Brewery. So yeah, please come out next Thursday. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it personally. It's that time of year for parties, so I'll be sharing lots of recipes for things you can bring to a party, or drinks you can make, punch ideas, cookie ideas, all kinds of things like that coming up in the next week on radio. Or I'm sorry, reciprocityradio.com, which is the site for this show, which has lots and lots and lots of recipes, a lot of good party appropriate things, but I have, as ever, more to share with you. What you're hearing in the background is a record that I picked up this week in Park Slope at a little record store. It's on the corner of 9th Street and 5th Avenue. They had 3 copies of it. It's a disco Christmas record, and I really love it. It's a Saul Soul Orchestra Christmas Jollies. It's pretty amazing. I don't know if you feel like I do, which is just sort of like oversaturated by holiday music, so I try to pick things that are not quite as common or getting as much airplay to share with you today. Anyway, let's get into it. So, we know Santa is Saint Nicholas, and based off the saint, and he's got reindeer and a big bag of gifts and flies everywhere, but like, where did the cookie thing come from? To me, this is confounding, so let's delve into that now. Okay. How did Santa get so hooked on cookies and milk? You know the Christmas routine, decorate the tree, wrap gifts, and leave out treats for Santa on Christmas Eve. Marketers in Hollywood reinforce that the cookie tradition is a big deal year after year. This year, there have been many commercials already about this. In the Santa Claus, Tim Allen's Santa tells the little girl that he can't eat fattening treats and then returns the next year to find soy milk instead. And Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone leaves out milk and cookies without his parents around to even prompt him. But anyway, it turns out the cookies and milk tradition hasn't left such an easy trail to trace. Well, we can thank the Dutch, along with other Northern Europeans, for inventing cookies and bringing them to America. Gingerbread made with honey and black pepper appeared as early as the 13th century in the Netherlands, and similarly flavored hard biscuits have been found through Northern Europe for centuries. German gingerbread houses, Norwegian pepperkaker, Swedish pepperkakor, Danish brunkager, and Dutch speculoos, made specifically for St. Nicholas Day on December 6th, according to the Oxford Companion of Sugar and Sweets. The first mention of Dutch cookies, that's C-O-O-K-E-Y-S, appeared in American cookbooks in the late 18th century. Gingerbread men were festooning Christmas trees by the next century. Dutch settlements such as New York had strong cookie culture, if you will, says Frederick Opie, professor of history and foodways at Babson College, and a blogger at Food as a Lens, tells The Salt, which is where this is. The Salt is a part of NPR, so this is where this is from. But cookies didn't look always like the cookies we make today. They would be large, almost plate-shaped, and they were dense, more like a cake, says Michael Crandall, author of Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. But given that sugar was still expensive, it's unlikely that Santa was snacking on them in those days. Sugar cookies were one of the more common things to give out as a present because sugar and spices used to be a luxury item that required great sacrifice for commoners to purchase or obtain. If you received a cookie, that was a really big deal. So hospitality during the Victorian era, congeniality was a big theme of the Victorian era, dating from 1837 to around 1901. And if you were a good host or hostess, you want to leave something out for a visitor like Santa to eat. After a long trip, Santa probably wants some scotch. But what is that? That's not a wholesome snack, similar to what you would give a child that comes to visit. That would be milk and cookies, says Crandall. One of the first literary references to milk and cookies on Christmas in America appeared in the 1870s in a short story called Polly, a Before Christmas Story. The Victorian era is also when the concept of childhood, with its special rituals of food and play and intermingled with learning, became a prominent thought or a prominent idea. To keep up the ruse that Santa was real, he thinks that parents would offer Santa the same treats that they would offer to visiting young children. And by at least 1869, kids seemed to be falling for it. In a column called The Letterbox in St. Nicholas, an illustrated magazine for young folks, volume 23, a girl named Anna M.S. writes to Santa that she and her brother wanted to leave out lunch for Santa Claus because he will be hungry. And when her father asks what they should leave for Santa, they reply, a glass of milk and some cookies. She then writes that her brother fell asleep and Papa drank the milk and ate the cookies. Anna wasn't apparently a gullible girl. St. Nicholas and Santa Claus. It's the same difference, right? But not so fast. Santa Claus wasn't always a jolly man with a bushy white beard and a round belly. In fact, the original St. Nicholas was born in Greece in 280 AD. The way you say that, it's hard to understand. He was a fiery, wiry, and defiant defender of church doctrine, and was known as a patron of children. But in the 1850s, St. Nicholas turns from being a rather imposing bishop, rewarding the good and punishing the bad in Dutch tradition, into a much happier fellow. Bruce Forbes, the author of Christmas, A Candid History, sees the figure of Santa Claus as a uniquely American creation. He thinks the influential illustrations by Thomas Nast depicted Santa as someone you'd want to leave treats out for. Thomas Nast helped develop much of the mythology we take for granted today, including locating Santa at the North Pole, elaborating on Santa's workshop, and giving him elves and the concept of naughty or nice. Nast also emphasized Santa's disciplinarian nature in his cartoons, which means the milk and cookies tradition might have evolved to be a last-minute bribe kids could give Santa to ensure they'd get what they wanted from him. And maybe the concept also helps keep them in line. Whatever the reason, the tradition has stuck, and now when we see a corpulent Santa, it makes sense. If you suppose that millions of children around the world leave out cookies, Santa theoretically consumes about 1 billion calories in cookies alone in one day. But as our pals at the 2A have learned a few years back, it's certainly not just cookies anymore. Santa could get anything from homemade pumpkin bread with cream cheese icing to apples or even rutabagas. Good thing Santa climbs down the chimney to burn off some calories. Anyway, that was kind of a history of why Santa wants cookies. Because I feel like cookies are just such a huge deal for Christmas. And maybe it's just more so than any other holiday. Even myself, I want to host a cookie decorating party, and I'm like, that's kind of ridiculous. I don't even know if that's fun. I'm just going to eat a bunch of sugar and get a headache, but it's still for some reason something I really want to do. which brings me to the next oddity that I'm really kind of stumped by. Gingerbread is delicious, but why is it shaped like a little man or woman or non-binary ginger figure? So we're going to answer that question now, too. And I haven't made gingerbread in a few years. I think I'm going to do that this year, but I don't know. And now we're going to find out why gingerbread men, and maybe after that I'll find out why do we make little houses out of cookies. There's so many things you just take for granted as tradition and never know the origin of, so this is fun for me. I hope it's fun for you listening out there. Anyway, ever wonder why gingerbread men are shaped like men in the first place? The answer can be traced back at least 100 years. According to Carol Levine, director of medieval study programs at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and author of The Reign of Elizabeth I, Queen Elizabeth I, I don't know. I never learned to read Roman numerals. It's very, very embarrassing. Queen Elizabeth I, 16th century reign, was known for elaborate royal dinners that included marzipan shaped like fruit, castles and birds, but the queen's retinue also included a royal gingerbread maker. She did do a banquet where she had gingerbread men made to represent foreign dignitaries and people in her court, says Levin. It was a creative time in history. After all, the English Renaissance was in full swing. Shakespeare was writing plays such as the comedy Love's Labor Lost, and I had but one penny in the world, thou shalt have it to buy gingerbread. The clown starred quips in that play. But it was also a time of great religious wars, and perhaps the gingerbread dignitaries would have been a part of what Levin calls the queen's clever diplomacy at a time when Anglican Britain stood opposite Catholic France and Spain. The queen wasn't the only person eating gingerbread men. Also during this time period, Gingerbread men were dished out by folk medicine practitioners, often described as witches or magicians, who would create them as love tokens for young women. If they could get the man of their choice to eat the gingerbread man that had been made for them, the idea was that the man would then fall in love with the young woman. So how did they become something to eat around the winter holidays? The popularity of gingerbread during the holidays can, at least in part, be attributed to the belief that spices heated you up in winter, says Michael Kondo, again the author of A Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. And gingerbread itself is even older than that, though Crondall points out that some of the earliest versions of gingerbread didn't have ginger and weren't always the bread either. Many of the earliest versions of gingerbread were basically honey cakes. Crondall traces honey bread or cakes back to ancient Greece and claims that ancient Roman men ate anatomically correct honey cakes before orgies to stimulate their sexual appetites. Any spices that were added would change over time as the popularity and availability of spices varied. Paul Friedman, author of Out of the East, Spices and Medieval Imagination, and a professor of history at Yale University, likewise cites a recipe for gingerbread, or G-Y-N-G-E-R-B-R-E-D-E, in a mid-15th century English cookbook manuscript, which does not even call for ginger. It had a chewy, toffee-like consistency, sort of like candy. And this is the recipe. Take a quart of honey and seethe it and skin it clear. Break saffron and powdered pepper and throw them on the honey. Take grated bread and moisten it. Combine with honey and spices. Add cinnamon and cloves and make into squares. If you want it to be red, color with red sandalwood. Overall, the big gingerbread traditions come from Germany, France, and the Netherlands, and the British Isles. Some English cooks were using sugar instead of honey by the end of the 16th century, and molasses by the 17th century. The addition of butter and cream gave rise to 18th century recipes that very much resemble the modern gingerbread cookies of today, according to the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America. So now we know a little bit more about why we make gingerbreads in the shape of humans. It's still kind of fascinating to me, but yeah, I hope you enjoyed that little bit of history. I have a lot more for you coming up, but I think we're going to take a short break to play some songs. You're going to hear from Sei Sumi and the 5678s, and I don't know, we'll see what else is in store. Thanks for listening. This is Reciprocity Radio here live on Radio Free Brooklyn, and yeah, keep listening. I'll be here till 6. We'll be right back.
This is the 5, 6, 7, 8 here. I wish Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Yeah. The bottom of the stair, I saw the last man standing. Well, let's go, let's go, woo! Oh, let's go, let's go, woo! Let's go, doggy and the puppy in the way. Well, in the way he was going on, he said, come on, baby, let's really go. Take a trip and the poster there, I'm gonna show you how to pop a boost. Well, the bottom of the stair, woo!
Where is Rudolph? Where is Blitzen, baby? Merry Christmas, Merry, Merry.
You just heard Shonen Knife with I Want to Eat, I Want to Eat Cookies. Before that, sorry, was Merry Christmas, I Don't Want to Fight Tonight with the Ramones. Before that, Rock and Roll Santa by the 5678. And topping that musical break was Christmas, It's Not a Biggie by Sei Su Mi. Yeah, this is Reciprocity Radio. I'm doing kind of a holiday episode here, talking about cookies, because I feel like that's the thing that comes up so often in Christmas time or holiday time. And it's just cookie pandemonium. I don't know. I looked up some more information about gingerbread in case we're curious still, because I didn't feel like I got all my answers. So let's delve into that for now, and then we'll have some more fun facts for you in this second half hour of the show. Records of honey cakes can be traced back to ancient Rome, and food historians ratify that ginger has been seasoning foodstuffs and drinks since antiquity. It is believed that gingerbread was first baked in Europe in the end of the 11th century, when the returning crusaders brought back the custom of spicy bread from the Middle East. Ginger was not only tasty, but it had properties that helped preserve the bread. According to a French legend, gingerbread was brought to Europe in the year 992 by the Armenian monk and later saint Gregory of Nicopolis, or Gregory Makar. He lived for 7 years in Fontenoy, France, near the town of where he taught gingerbread cooking to priests and other Christians. He died in the year 999. An early medieval Christian legend elaborates on the Gospel of Matthew's account of the birth of Jesus. According to the legend, attested to in a Greek document from the 8th century, of presumed Irish origin and translated into Latin with the title a collection of flowers. In addition to gold, frankincense, and myrrh given as gifts by the three wise men from the East, ginger was the gift of one wise man, Magus, who was unable to complete the journey from Bethlehem. As he was lingering in his last days in the city of Syria, Magus gave his chest of ginger roots to the rabbi, who kindly cared for him in his illness. The rabbi told him of the prophecies of the great king who was to come to the Jews, one of which that he would be born in Bethlehem, which in Hebrew meant the house of bread. The rabbi was accustomed to having his young students make houses of bread to eat over time to nourish the hope for their Messiah. Magus suggested adding ground up ginger to the bread for zest and flavor. Gingerbread, as we know it today, descends from the medieval European culinary traditions. Gingerbread was also shaped into different forms by monks in Franconia, Germany, in the 13th century. Lebkuchen bakers are recorded as early as 1296 in Ulm and 1395 in Nuremberg, Germany. Nuremberg was recognized as the gingerbread capital of the world when, in the 1600s, the guild started to employ master bakers and skilled workers to create complicated works of art from gingerbread. Medieval bakers used carved boards to create elaborate designs. During the 13th century, the custom spread across Europe. It was taken to Sweden in the 13th century by German immigrants, and there are references from Vadstena Abbey of Swedish nuns baking gingerbread to ease indigestion in 1444. The traditional sweetener is honey, used by the guild in Nuremberg, and spices are used are ginger, cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg, and cardamom. Gingerbread figurines date back to the 15th century, and figural biscuit making was practiced in the 16th century. The first documented instance of figure-shaped gingerbread biscuits is from, like we learned earlier, the Elizabeth I of England, who had gingerman made for in the likeness of some of her most important guests. So gingerbread is something I would never have known. Gingerbread bakers were gathered into professional guilds. In many European countries, gingerbread bakers were a distinct component of the baker's guild. Gingerbread baking developed into an acknowledged profession. In the 17th century, only professional gingerbread bakers were permitted to bake gingerbread except at Christmas and Easter, when everyone was allowed to. In Europe, gingerbreads were sold in special shops and at seasonal markets that sold sweets and gingerbread shaped as hearts, stars, soldiers, babies, riders, trumpets, swords, pistols, and animals. It was especially sold outside of churches and on Sundays. Religious gingerbread wreaths were purchased for the particular religious events such as Christmas and Easter. And the decorated gingerbreads were given as a present to adults and children alike, or given as a love token, or bought particularly for weddings, when gingerbreads were distributed to the wedding guests. A gingerbread relief of the patron saint was frequently given to a gingerbread cookie of a patron saint was frequently given as a gift on a person's name day, and that day of the associated saint with his or her given name. It was custom to make biscuits and paint them as window decorations, and the most intricate gingerbreads were also embellished with ice patterns, often using colors, also gilded with gold leaf. Gingerbread was also worn as a talisman in battle or as a protection against evil spirits. It became a significant form of popular art in Europe. Major centers of gingerbread mold carving include Lyon, Nuremberg, Pest, Prague, Paradus, Ulm, and Turin. Gingerbread molds often displayed actual happenings by portraying new rulers and their consorts. For example, substantial mold collections are held at the Ethnographic Museum in Turin, Poland, and the Bread Museum in Ulm, Germany. During winter months, medieval gingerbread pastries, usually dipped in wine or other alcoholic beverages, are consumed. In America, the German-speaking communities of Pennsylvania and Maryland continued this tradition into the 20th century, and that tradition survived into colonial North America, where the pastries were baked as ginger snap cookies and gained favor as Christmas tree decorations. The tradition of making decorative gingerbread houses started in Germany in the 1800s, and according to certain researchers, the first gingerbread houses were the result of a well-known Grimm's fairy tale, Hansel and Gretel, in which two children abandoned in the forest found an edible home made of bread with sugar decorations. After this book was published, German bakers began baking ornamented fairy tale houses of Lebkuchen or gingerbread. And these became popular during Christmas, a tradition that became American with Pennsylvania and German immigrants. According to other food historians, the Grimm brothers were speaking about something that already existed, so they're not sure if that was actually inspired by the Grimms or just the Grimms were inspired by it. So yeah, that is a lot more about gingerbread. I had no idea there was that story about the saint and little houses and, oh my goodness. Wow. So now you know why we eat that at the holidays, and that there is apparently a gift to the magic of ginger. Who knew? I did not know that. Up next, something that's more ubiquitous in the 20th and 21st century, and more ubiquitous in America. I didn't know this either, actually. I made a mistake there. Only 21st century. This cookie is insanely popular. And has only been around for, like, I don't know, not even 100 years. So we're going to talk about Santa's favorite, or that's what I always heard, chocolate chip cookies. So I had no idea this was such a relatively new, in terms of history, invention. But it's true. Let's see. So like most iconic foods, the Toll House cookie has a storied past. And it is interesting because chocolate chip cookie really can't be separated from Toll House. That is where it was invented. And you will find out that as I read this segment here. Many people hear mention of Toll House chocolate chip cookies, and they can't help but think of, oh gosh, Phoebe in the episode of Friends, where she wants to give Monica her grandmother's secret chocolate chip cookie recipe as an engagement present, but the recipe was lost in a fire. And the secret recipe turns out to be Nestle's Toll House cookie recipe. Now, that's not what I think of, but what I do think of is the fact that one of the first, I think when I was like probably, I don't know, 11 or 10, maybe even younger, I knew how to make this recipe from memory. Like, just at that, it's pretty simple, and I feel like even now I might be able to get it right, but I memorized it, and we used to keep a little jar around the holidays for some reason of mini chocolate chips, like, out on the counter. I don't know why we did this. And it was a Christmas jar. You could just walk into the house and, like, you know, spoon some chocolate into your hand. I loved that as a kid. It's probably to this day why I am such a huge dark chocolate fan. because I like got started on bittersweet. Never had a taste for milk chocolate at all, which just might be, again, kind of an American thing. Anyway, yeah, the Nestle Toll House cookie recipe is like infamous, and it's like the go-to recipe if you're making cookies. So when I hear a mention of the celebrated cookie, I think of childhood. And here's more of a history of how this cookie actually ever came to be. The birthplace of Toll House chocolate chip cookies was in Plymouth County town, in the Plymouth County town of Whitman, Massachusetts, located between Boston and Cape Cod. Whitman is where passengers paid their toll, changed horses, and fueled up on a good meal before hitting the road again. Ruth Graves Wakefield was the owner, along with her husband, and the chef at an inn, the Toll House Inn. And she was best known for her lobster dinners and fabulous desserts, including a thin butterscotch nut cookie served with ice cream. In later years, the restaurant became a spot for Bostonians and locals to celebrate special occasions. It was a very popular restaurant, even though it was never actually a quote-unquote toll house, says Paula Fisher, Director of Marketing and Group Services of the Plymouth County Convention and Visitor Bureau. The food options were very Americana, and of course, seafood, as the coast is less than 30 miles away. The inn burned to the ground in 1984, but the Toll House sign remains, and although the property is now condos, the celebrated cookies still get some love in Whitman. The town dropped a giant fake Toll House cookie on New Year's Eve in 2013. Wakefield invented the Toll House chocolate chip cookie around 1938, and she used Nestle's semi-sweet chocolate in the recipe, which originally called the dessert chocolate crunch cookie because the chocolate didn't completely melt. The cookie was a local stud, but how did Massachusetts' favorite cookie become a national sensation? Well, World War II soldiers from Massachusetts were stationed overseas received care packages from home with the cookies. They shared them with other soldiers who wrote home to their families asking if they too could receive some Toll House chocolate chip cookie care packages. As a result, Wakefield received hundreds of letters from people around the world begging for the recipe. And now there's this, underneath this is this wonderful poster, and it says very handsome soldier's face, and then it says his one weakness, Toll House cookies from home, and it gives you the recipe. As the cookies continued to grow in popularity, the savvy chef struck a business deal with Andrew Nestle. She gave the chocolate company the right to use her recipe as well as the Toll House name. Nestle printed the recipe on their chocolate chip cookie packaging. What she got in return was a lifetime supply of Nestle chocolate and $1. Today, the Toll House chocolate chip cookie is the official state cookie of Massachusetts, and it still melts hearts across the country. So yeah, I was surprised by that it was such a new invention in terms of history, because it's pretty much, you know, like, it's probably the most... If you ask someone what they think a cookie is in America, that's what we think. We think this specific thing, which I didn't realize was, first of all, American, or just, like, not as common. It is by far the most popular cookie in America. So that was kind of fascinating to learn. Anyway, let's take another quick music break, and then I'll be back. We can go through what the difference between a biscuit and a cookie is, since we were talking a lot about history across the world, and how there are different designations for these types of things, even though they're often the same thing, just depending on where you're eating it. So anyway, up next, we're going to hear from Crocodiles and Dum Dum Girls and the Ravenettes. Hope you enjoy what you hear. Thanks for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn.
Thank you. lights are coming on now. How I wish that it snowed now. I don't feel like going home now. I wish that I could stay. All the trees are on display now. And it's cold.
That was a quick little musical break there with The Christmas Song by the Ravenettes, and before that, Merry Christmas Baby, Please Don't Die, once Crocodiles and Dum Dum Girls together in that song. This has been Reciprocity Radio. I'm here every Sunday at 5, and yeah, I hope you enjoyed this kind of interesting delve into cookie history. I just want to remind you again that we are having our holiday party, Radio Free Brooklyn's holiday party, next week, Thursday the 13th, and if you RSVP on RadioFreeBrooklyn.org/holiday2018, you can get 2 free beer tickets at the party, which is going to be at Raven Brewery. That's on 52 Harrison Place. I'm a huge fan of their beers, so I'm excited to check it out. That's from 7 to 10 this Thursday coming up, December 13th. Yeah, hope to see you guys there. Please come out. I think it'll be a lot of fun. And yeah, we'll love to celebrate. Lots of holiday parties and fun things coming up. It's that time of year. Speaking of which, if you are a fan of the Great British Bake Off, I am. They have a holiday special. I just noticed this with 4 past contestants. I think it's on Netflix. Check that out. And that brings me to this last segment, which is, what in the world is the difference between a biscuit and a cookie? Because if you watch the Bake Off, they consistently make things that I've never even heard of or seen, and it's always like a biscuit. It's not, you know, we're like, that is literally a cookie. What's the deal here? So let's do a little explainer of that before we close out the show today. So biscuits. In the UK, your biscuit might be topped with chocolate or have currants in it. You might dip it in a cup of tea or have 1 or 2 or 3 as a snack after lunch. In the US, however, you might put bacon and eggs on it to smother it in gravy or have it for breakfast. Or you might put a piece of chicken on it and have it for dinner. So Oxford Dictionary notes the difference, giving two definitions for the word. But how do these two very different meanings come to be? According to Oxford English Dictionary, the word biscuit comes from the Latin biscotum or panem, which means bread twice baked, which would explain the hard, crunchy quality of a British biscuit. An American biscuit is more like what the Brits would call a scone, and an American scone is something else entirely, and the pronunciation is another matter entirely. It's unclear how these two different foods came to have the same word, and we can only speculate about the influence of the French language on the southern United States. Cookie The word cookie opens up a whole other can of worms. In the UK, a cookie is a soft, squishy, moist biscuit, for lack of a better word, and British cookies tend to be bigger and more substantial than British biscuits. In the US, a cookie covers both what British call a biscuit and a cookie. The word comes from the Dutch kokje, or K-O-K-K-O-E-K-J-E, meaning little cake, and could have been popularized in the US due to the early Dutch colonization, although we'll never really know for sure. So, it's not the clearest definition, but it is confusing, honestly. Either way, I hope you have some fun baking planned in the weeks ahead as we get closer to Christmas and New Year's and all that stuff. And please check out reciprocityradio.com. All my past episodes of this show are on there, plus hundreds of recipes, blog posts, all kinds of fun things, and I'll be adding a ton more this week as we get closer to the big day, Christmas. So check that out. I'll be posting things like punch recipes, cocktail recipes, cookie recipes, things that you can bring to a party that are easy to throw together. And if you're hosting, I have tips for that too. So yeah, check out reciprocityradio.com, and I'll see you next Sunday here on Radio Free Brooklyn, live at 5. I'm going to take us out with the Pretenders, 2,000 Miles. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of your Sunday.
Coming on.